Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. College sports governing body takes in billions of dollars each year, but is the NCAA on its last legs? Ahead on Only a Game, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch makes his case. Also, how fantasy sports acumen applies to reality, and our intrepid frontier correspondent captures the sound of iron hitting wood at Freedom, Indiana's biannual tomahawk throwing competition. Also ahead, Detroit Tigers 23-game winner Justin Verlander has learned how to pitch.
He can throw fastball, curveball for strikes at will, change his speed, change his location, and the guy on the mound is just playing mean.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In terms of Major League Baseball's division races, it hasn't been a great September. The Angels could overtake the Rangers in the AL West, and I guess the Red Sox could still catch the Yankees in the AL East, though Boston is perhaps as likely to stumble out of the playoffs altogether, but otherwise the postseason lineups are essentially set. Joining me now to discuss the stretch run is the baseball guy we generously share with ESPN, Tim Kirkjian. Hi, Tim.
How are you, Bill?
Very well, thank you. Before we get to the various races, let's talk a little about Mariano Rivera, who saved his 600th game on Tuesday. It's a considerable advantage, of course, to play for a team that succeeds a lot, in this case, the Yankees. But will Rivera go down in history as the game's greatest closer?
He already is, Bill. I mean, there isn't any doubt. 14, 30 save seasons. He made 12 All-Star games. He's had 12 years with an ERA under 2. And what separates him is his postseason work. He has 42 postseason saves. Next most on that list is Brad Lidge with 18. And Rivera has the lowest ERA, 0.71, of any pitcher in postseason history who's pitched at least 30 innings. There's never been anybody like him in baseball history as far as closers go, and he's basically done it all with one pitch, a cutter, which he just kind of sails through the strike zone.
The Red Sox have split their last two games with the Rays. They now hold a tenuous 4-game lead over Tampa Bay in the AL wildcard standings. What accounts for Boston's shaky September?
Well, their pitching has been really bad, Bill. They have an ERA of about 6.5 runs a game this month alone. Their bullpen has been just as bad as their starters. And the other part of it, or one other part of it, John Lackey, has the highest ERA of any Red Sox starter through 25 starts of any season in their history. It's just unbelievable how poorly he has pitched for most of the year and how this really good club has struggled this badly in the month of September. And I just didn't see it coming. I thought after their terrible April and once they figured it all out, they would be the best team in the American League going into the playoffs, and now I can't think that way.
Tim, this week Philadelphia became the first team to clinch a playoff spot. The Phillies will win more than 100 games this season, and I assume they would have to be the favorite to represent the National League in the World Series.
Bill, they're the best team in baseball, period. Their starting pitching is sensational. They are going to become the first team to have a starter's ERA under 3 since the 1992 Braves. Hunter Pence has become their number 5 hitter and has been a tremendous addition for them. And even though Chase Utley hasn't hit since he's been back, he has changed the look of that order. And keep in mind, Bill, if they win 98 games this year, which of course they will become the first team ever to improve their win total 5 years in a row, and that with that streak beginning with a 500 team, meaning they keep getting better, and they were already pretty good when this streak began.
The Brewers have a great shot at winning the National League Central, but this week their star player doused spirits a bit when he apparently said this would be his last season in Milwaukee. What's that all about?
fielder said it would probably be his last year in Milwaukee, and he was being kind. It is going to be his last year in Milwaukee because the Brewers simply are not going to be able to afford somebody of his caliber. They can afford him at $13 million a year, but Scott Boras is his agent. He's going to free agency, and he's going to get more than $20 million a year. He is a very, very good all-around player, very underrated. But exactly why he would come out and say this now when consistently all season he said, look, you know, let's just see how it goes this year, and then we'll talk about the contract after the year. And then he brings it up 2 weeks before the playoffs begin. That was a little bit odd, to say the least.
The Detroit Tigers have certainly gotten hot at the right time. They're going to finish on top of the AL Central by plenty, but how good will the Tigers be in the playoffs?
They have a chance to be the best team in the American League going into the playoffs, and I don't think anybody thought that 3 weeks ago. But in that time, the Tigers have pulled off their biggest winning streak since 1934. They have the best pitcher in the game, Justin Verlander, on the top of their rotation. And in that first five-game series, you might see him twice in five games, which gives them a chance to win against any team. But mostly, Miguel Cabrera has become, again, the best hitter in the American League. And Victor Martinez, who they picked up in the offseason for precisely this, has been a great hitter down the stretch also.
Justin Verlander, 23 wins and counting, has got to bring up for some people the old discussion of whether a pitcher should ever be named most valuable player. What do you think?
I just think the only way that a pitcher wins the MVP is when there isn't an everyday player having an MVP season. And yet, you know, we have Jacoby Ellsbury and Adrian Gonzalez of the Red Sox. We have Curtis Granderson of the Yankees, Miguel Cabrera of the Tigers, and Jose Bautista of the Blue Jays, who's having the best year of anyone. So if those guys weren't around, Verlander would win, and I would vote for him. But there are five everyday players having an MVP-caliber season, which is why I don't think Verlander can win, and it explains why it's been almost 20 years since a pitcher won the MVP, Dennis Eckersley in 1992.
Despite the relative lack of suspense as we count down the final days of the regular season, there is great potential for some intriguing postseason matchups. Are there pairings that you would particularly like to see?
Well, there are a bunch of pairings once we get to the World Series, but I think even before then, there's all sorts of interest there. I mean, if you just look at the American League, the Texas Rangers are gearing up for more, and they're trying to get back to the World Series, and it'll be real interesting to see if they can beat the Yankees again in the playoffs, and I think they're going to play them now in the first round. There's always Boston, New York, which we might end up seeing. Also, a Detroit against anybody now is very interesting. And over in the National League, you know, the Arizona Diamondbacks, Bill, I picked them last in the division. They're going to win the division. How good am I looking right now? Whoever they play in the first round, it's going to be fascinating. And if by some miracle they end up beating the Phillies, which they might play them and, you know, they have an outside chance to beat them, that would you know, support what I've always said about baseball. You never know what's going to happen. They always play the games, and sometimes or always it'll surprise you.
Tim Kirkchin covers baseball for ESPN and for Only a Game. Tim, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
Baseball fans in the Motor City are watching perhaps the best pitcher in the game right now. On Tuesday, Justin Verlander won his 11th straight game. He now boasts a gaudy 23-5 record and an ERA of 2.36. When Verlander is on the mound, chances are Detroit will rack up another win, which Tigers fans hope he will do tomorrow in Oakland. WDET's Noah Ovshinsky has the story.
The numbers don't lie. Justin Verlander is having a great season. He leads the American League in strikeouts, victories, and pitches thrown. He's also one of the big reasons, besides some monster hitters, that the Tigers are a favorite to play baseball deep into October. The low-key Verlander credits one pitch in particular.
Fastball control has been better for the most part this year. You know, just the maturation process, just learning how to pitch a little bit better at this level.
Ask Tigers fans why they think Verlander is having such a stellar season, and a common theme emerges.
The maturity this year, I like the fact that he doesn't panic, doesn't get into his head, he doesn't give up that big blow-up inning, and he's just he's really come around. He's got the total game.
What we love to see is like when he gets angry, guy gets on base and he goes to another level. And I think that that absolutely thrills people to see someone take control of a situation like that and shut it down.
He can throw fastball, curveball for strikes at will, change his speed, change his location, and the guy on the mound is just plain mean.
Tigers pitching legend Denny McClain agrees that Verlander has matured as a pitcher.
He's learned how to pitch versus be a thrower. He's been a thrower for quite some time, and this year, somewhere, somehow, either somebody got a hold of him or the lights went on with his stuff, and he has learned the art of pitching.
Mastering this art, according to McClain, comes down to a certain mindset.
You hope to throw a strike with various pitches. Now he knows he can throw a strike with his pitches. I mean, now he knows how to set a guy up from time to time. He knows what he needs to throw a guy when you don't always pitch a guy the same way. You don't pitch him the same way when you're in trouble as you do when you're not in trouble.
In recent months, Verlander has often been compared to McClain, who in 1968 won 31 games, a feat that will likely never be repeated. He also led the Tigers to a World Series title that year and won the Cy Young Award. Barring a total meltdown, Verlander has a good shot at winning the award this year. Even Tigers manager Jim Leland, who rarely compares pitchers or seasons, concedes that Verlander has been on a roll for most of the season. As for the pitcher's future, Leland is bullish.
I think this guy's got a chance to have a lot of great seasons. You know, this guy's a horse, and he's got a chance to be around for a long time.
But, and there is almost always a but when talking about pitchers and their futures, Leland notes that nothing is guaranteed.
You know, the biggest thing with the pitchers basically is health. If they can maintain their health over a longer period of time, obviously they have a better chance to have a lot of great seasons.
Denny McClain agrees. His own career was cut short, in part, due to health issues.
Anything can happen to a pitcher. That's the worst part. You have that sudden injury, that you never recover from. To try to predict what he's going to do from this point forward is impossible.
For now, though, Tigers fans, and players for that matter, are reveling in Verlander's history-making performance this year. Pundits even bring up his name and the words most valuable player in the same sentence. Verlander, for his part, downplays the hype.
You know, they say I'm just coming into my prime, but, you know, you never know in this game. It's a funny game, so I need to work my butt off and try to stay healthy for a long time.
I asked Verlander how he's dealing with all the attention and pressure. He says there is none. All he has to do, he says, is pitch. For Only a Game, I'm Noah Ovshinsky in Detroit.
Hey, everybody. Have you heard about the Tigers' incredible right-hander? He can break 100 miles per hour. I'm talking about Justin Verlander. He's the Phillies' hope for the future. He's Justin Verlander.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Trevor Sanford, a golfer with an imagination, found himself stuck in traffic one day on the M25, the 117-mile motorway that nearly encircles London. With nothing better to think about, Mr. Sanford began wondering whether he could golf his way around the M25, which, by his reckoning, would mean playing the 31 courses nearest to the highway's 31 junctions in 31 days. Not content to merely dream, Mr. Sanford took a month off work and proceeded to walk 210 miles and hit 2,789 shots in completing his circuit of the courses closest to the highway. In so doing, he raised 7,700 pounds for cancer research. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the real business of fantasy sports. But first, over the years, the NCAA has been criticized by sports writers, commentators, college athletes, and coaches. The current issue of the Atlantic Monthly features an article titled The Shame of College Sports, in which Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch discusses the dubious history and current endangered state of the governing body of college sports. Taylor Branch joins me now on the line. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. Nice to be here.
The designation student-athlete is so familiar that people may not even wonder how the term came into being. You write that it was carefully chosen. What did those running the NCAA accomplish by designating college players, quote, student-athletes?
It was done in the early 1950s, according to Walter Byers, the head of the NCAA, who said it was explicitly codified and created to help defend the NCAA and colleges in lawsuits and workmen's compensation cases by injured athletes. Basically, colleges did not want to have to pay medical bills for particularly football players who broke their necks. So they created this term to resist workmen's compensation lawsuits, saying that the players were not really just players at the university. They were student athletes, which was this specialized category. It's a pretty cynical thing. I was surprised. I had no idea of this going in. But the courts have widely deferred to the NCAA and to the concept of amateurism.
You refer to, quote, two of the noble principles on which the NCAA justifies its existence, amateurism and student-athlete, as, quote, cynical hoaxes, legalistic confections propagated by the universities so they can exploit the skills and fame of young athletes. What are some of the particulars that led you to that conclusion?
Nearly everybody I talk to bridles at the idea of paying these student-athletes, and the principle by which we don't pay them is called amateurism, meaning we enshrine the notion that they're supposed to be amateurs and doing this for the sheer love of the game, and therefore they shouldn't want to be paid. But the problem with that is that to impose amateurism on someone else, you've got to have some sort of stronger basis. There is none in law. Nowhere is it illegal to pay college players or for college players to seek to be paid, since they're generating millions of dollars in income. It can only be done by a tradition or by a cartel or a conspiracy.
You found in the NCAA's governance system, quote, the unmistakable whiff of the plantation, end quote. But football and basketball players who are recruited by universities have aspired to be recruited. They know what they're getting into, don't they?
Well, certainly, but they don't have any alternative because the NCAA prohibits colleges from offering them any money and prohibits players from bargaining for their services. So it is a cartel in that sense. If you're a graduate teacher and you want to teach, the university can pay you to teach, and you can bargain for your salary. If you are an undergraduate and you want to work in the campus bookstore, you can bargain for your salary there. But if you're an athlete, not only can you not bargain for your salary above your scholarship, but you can't even bargain for the terms of your scholarship or anything else.
Over 25 years ago, the Supreme Court essentially eliminated the NCAA's stranglehold on college football. How has the organization been able to maintain control of the annual basketball tournament, which is the main source of the NCAA's income?
Only precariously. For its first 30 years, the NCAA controlled both all football contracts with television and all basketball. Then the football schools revolted, and they said, we don't want to do this. We want to control our own money. What saved the NCAA when the football schools revolted and took half their treasury was that it occurred right at the time when the March Madness basketball tournament was taking off, and its income skyrocketed 50-fold in 30 years. They now get $771 million directly in a check from the network, CBS Turner in this case, to the NCAA, which uses it to pay all the 1,000-member colleges and the winners of the tournament and the whole NCAA budget. 95% of its budget comes from this one tournament. And the NCAA's great fear is that the big football schools that took football away could take basketball away, too.
You suggest that stories about players receiving money and favors from boosters or players having their papers written for them distract us from a more significant issue, which you define as, quote, the denial of fundamental due process for college athletes. How do we address that?
Well, it is a legal question. Congress changed the Olympics. You know, the Olympics used to be as amateur as college sports.
Mm-hmm.
In 1978, Congress passed the Amateur Sports Act, which took the control of our Olympic teams away from the Amateur Athletic Union and gave them to 39 Olympic committees, each of whom allowed current athletes to have a voting stake in Olympic policy. And within 10 years, the Olympics went pro, not only in the United States, but around the world. The Olympic Committee expunged the word amateur from its charter in 1986. Michael Phelps can make millions of dollars and swim in the Olympics, but he couldn't swim on his team at the college team at the University of Michigan because the NCAA required him to be an amateur and not even appear at the meet.
Various studies produced by the Knight Commission and other groups have suggested ways in which the NCAA might be reformed. University presidents should take control of their athletic departments rather than letting them operate as separate entities. Stiffer penalties should be assessed against schools that break the rules, things like that. Has there ever been any real reform of the system?
The NCAA has made some effort in academic standards and reforming schools on their graduation rates and things like that that don't really pertain to money but have to do with academic standards.
Let's assume that the NCAA is reformed or that some of these changes that you're suggesting do occur. What would be the trickle-down theory on non-revenue sports that depend on football and basketball generating a lot of money for their very existence?
Well, we don't really know, but at least it would be an honest and acknowledged relationship. I don't know exactly how it would happen. Of course, if I were at a college, I'd be very loath to see the revenue sports gobble up all the others so that the only sports you offered were the ones that made money. There are a number of reformers who say that big money sports don't really belong in all of these schools. We're the only country in the world that houses big money sports in institutions of higher learning.
Assuming that college sports is going to continue to have a governing body, how should that body operate?
First of all, it should be open, and it should include the athletes themselves as members. One of the reasons that the student-athlete formulation worked back in the 1950s to set in motion this unfair structure is that the athletes are not members of the NCAA. They have no vote, they have no membership, they have no representation. It's only the institution. They should have some voting representation just as the Olympic athletes do. These kids are maintaining dual careers that are enormously demanding, both as students and as athletes. There may be a question whether it's practical to have professional sports and quality education coexist, but we don't have that debate right now because we're so diverted on all these phony scandals.
Pulitzer Prize winner Taylor Branch is the author of Parting the Waters, The Clinton Tapes, and many other books. His article titled The Shame of College Sports appears in the current issue of The Atlantic Monthly. Mr. Branch, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. Enjoyed being with you.
To hear more of my conversation with Taylor Branch, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcast. This is how fantasy football works. By means of a draft, which perhaps features various adult beverages, you and some of your friends create teams made up of real NFL players, or more accurately, made up of the statistics those real players generate. Your team might include a Packer, two Cowboys, an Eagle, and so on. If the players you've chosen perform brilliantly in actual games, your fantasy team will thrive. It works the same way with fantasy baseball and other games. A.J. Mass makes his living as a fantasy sports analyst with ESPN. Thus, it is in his interest for you to take fantasy sports seriously, which helps to explain why he has written a book titled How Fantasy Sports Explains the World. A.J. Mass joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me on, Bill.
You've listed the 12 personalities that every fantasy league should have. Tell me why each league should have at least one idiot savant and at least one mad scientist.
Well, you know, I think part of the fun is you know, someone who's just going to go, I saw this guy play for like 2 minutes in the preseason, and I saw him like catch a ball with like one hand on the top of his helmet, and he's got a funny-sounding name, so I'm going to pick him in the third round. And they win. Guys like this win. But, I mean, that's what's great about it. It throws an element of surprise into it. So you really want one of these idiot savants in there who just knows nothing about the game but somehow picks players and makes trades and suddenly is a competitive team. It really keeps you on your toes and forces you to look at the players a little differently. Having a mad scientist, someone who wants to try and change the league's rules, it's like, oh, let's throw punters into the mix and get extra points if he downs it inside the five. And how about if the coach throws the red flag and it bounces twice, we also get extra points. I mean, it's ridiculous. You'd never actually play with it, but every so often you get a good idea in there.
You bring the stock market into your discussion. What can operating a fantasy league baseball or football team teach one about Wall Street?
Well, I think we value players in fantasy. I mean, that's what we're doing is we're trying to sell high and buy low. Mm-hmm. I mean, a guy who hits 450 for the month of April, well, you know no one's ever hit 450 for an entire season. Ted Williams, 401 was so many years ago now. We might never, ever see a 400 hitter again. So at what point do I say now's the time to sell him to someone who might not get that concept or someone who might, you know, be saying, well, I've got a guy who's 200 and I don't think it's going to be any good, but you can look and see, well, he's going to hit 300 for the season. If he's hitting 200 now, he might hit 400 the rest of the way. And I think stocks kind of operate the same way. It's that their value fluctuates depending on people's confidence in them. And if you can see the value in underachiever before anyone else, that's how you make money on the stock market. It's a tool that we use in fantasy sports, even if we're not realizing that we're doing it that way.
What are some of the other realms in which it's been apparent that experience as the owner of a fantasy league team has served somebody well?
Well, you know, I was on a jury, and I realized that a lot of the ways that you try and form consensus amongst a group that might not necessarily agree but has to come to a decision is forged in fantasy leagues where you have to come up with a bunch of rules to govern your league. And some of the owners might say, well, I would like to do it this way, and I'd like to do it this way. No, I'd like to do it this way. And you as a I was a fantasy commissioner who's kind of in charge of settling all the disputes. And I would come up with, with a very good way of balancing the needs of everybody and trying to say, well, you know, if you give on this issue, then maybe you'll give on this issue and maybe we can all get along. When I was on the jury, I found myself naturally taking the lead role and saying, well, what if we could agree to this? And everyone, what if we agreed to this? And therefore, you know, rather than being, you know, in sequester for like weeks on end, it was a one-day sequester. And we got unanimity by the end of the next day.
For a time before you became a fantasy sports analyst, you worked in a casino as a dealer. Did that help to prepare you for your current position?
I think people don't really have a firm grasp of probabilities. So, you know, I would be on the roulette wheel, and I would have a wheel that's going red, 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 15 straight reds, and the whole casino would come running over all at once. And half of them would be convinced, this wheel is a red wheel. Red always comes up, and they put all their money on red. And the other half would be equally convinced, this wheel is due for black. And of course, it's a 50-50 shot. Each spin is independent, and they couldn't figure out why when, you know, black comes up, all the reds were like, oh my goodness, you cheated. How did I didn't cheat. And it's the exact same thing that I get as a fantasy football analyst is that, you know, I could say, this week I think, you know, Matthew Stafford is going to throw for 300 yards. And like, well, Matthew Stafford's never done it before. How can you say that? And the others say, well, yeah, he was hurt. He must be due because now he's healthy. And no matter what I say, you're going to get half the people who are going to completely agree with me and half the people who are going to completely think I'm out of my mind. And I think I'm a little bit more prepared for that because I've seen it firsthand.
You write that the real kick in operating a fantasy football team is not in waiting to see how your players will perform each week, but in contemplating and then consummating trades with your fellow owners. I wonder, does this excitement result simply from the competition, or are fantasy team owners trying to demonstrate that they're smarter than the general managers of actual teams?
Well, I think certainly if you're a Mets fan, as I am, there's certain joy in saying that I can actually have a team that I can follow that can win. It's been a long season. In general, I think fantasy sports is a way for us to get control over events that we really have absolutely no control over. You know, when I was a kid growing up, teams stayed together a lot longer. Now, you're like, well, who are these guys? I'm rooting for laundry. I'm not rooting for guys. Fantasy sports is a way for you to take those guys and say, you know what? I'm committing to these guys. These guys are my guys, and I'm not trading them. Or, you know, if they're doing poorly, you can say, well, you know, maybe the general manager of the team isn't going to recognize that they're doing poorly, but I recognize it, and I'm getting rid of them before my team's performance suffers.
How many fantasy football teams or teams operating in other sports do you currently run?
You know what? I find myself unable to do more than one in a sport. Then you find yourself rooting for and against the same guy in the same week, and my head will explode with that kind of thing. You know, if I got 15 teams and, you know, I'm rooting for this guy in three but not in four others, and, you know, if he does well but not too well, then in six other leagues I don't make the playoffs. I don't have a flow chart in my head that can control that.
All right, AJ, I have just one final question. When you meet somebody for the first time and they ask what you do, do you ever hesitate to say, I'm a professional fantasy sports analyst?
That's not exactly how I lead. usually I just say I'm a writer, and then, you know, they probably will either gloss over and go, oh, and that means it was good for me not to have brought it up in the first place. Or they'll get way too interested, and I'll try and, you know, ease my way over to the punch bowl. And, you know, look at the flowers over there. You know, run. Because people are so passionate about fantasy sports, when they do find out what I do, it tends to be a very, very, very long conversation.
AJ Mass is, in fact, a professional fantasy sports analyst with ESPN. He's also the author of How Fantasy Sports Explains the World, subtitled What Pujols and Peyton Can Teach Us About Wookiees and Wall Street. The book is published by Skyhorse. The author joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. AJ, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. It's my pleasure.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world. extension.harvard.edu. And Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
The Washington Nationals are not going to the playoffs, but some of them are headed for Smurfville, or at least they were. As part of the rookie initiation, 16 members of the Nationals were required to dress as the adorable pointy-headed blue creatures. Wilson Ramos was Smurfette, Danny Espinosa was Hefty Smurf, and pitcher Steven Strasburg, who was cast as Papa Smurf and who stands 6'4 and weighs 220 pounds, said, "I think I'm the biggest Smurf anybody's ever seen." First baseman Chris Marrero said, "This is what baseball is all about, being a rookie and being able to do this with my friends." Nobody had the heart to ruin it for the little fellow by telling him that what baseball is supposed to be all about at the professional level is winning games.
La, 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 la. Now you know the tune.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, you've heard of Boom Goes the Dynamite.
Well, Boom Goes the Dynamite!
Thunk Goes the Tomahawk. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce. You just heard him back there a minute ago for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Whew, the dynamite went boom.
Absolutely. In the first week of the NFL season, New England's Tom Brady threw for 517 yards. Panthers rookie quarterback Cam Newton shattered the record for yards in an NFL debut with 422 of them. Drew Brees and Chad Henne both had 400-plus yard games. Any chance we'll see some defense in week two?
There's already some rumbling among NFL old-timers that the rules adjustments have gone too far the other way, and now it's pretty much a pitch-and-catch league. The problem is, of course, all these rules were done for the safety of the players. I don't want to see them rolled back. Sooner or later, the athletes who play defensive back and the coaches who scheme them will find a way to cut this down. But 300 yards in a game is now going to be that's the new normal in the NFL.
See, maybe this will just show how little I know about football, but I assumed that these statistics were because the offenses were ahead of the defenses because of the lockout and the shorter training camps and less time for coaches to work with players and stuff.
I don't know. I mean, a lot of pass defenses reacting to situations that happen right in front of you, so I wouldn't put it on the lockout. I just think that, you know, you've got better athletes, you've got more creative offensive coordinators, you've got really good quarterbacks, a number of really good quarterbacks, unlike anything we've seen in the NFL for about 10 or 15 years. And also, you've got changes in the rules that make it harder to hit the quarterback and harder to do things to the receivers prior to their catching the ball. So, yeah, you're going to see numbers like this.
Fans of Broncos backup quarterback Tim Tebow vowed this week to raise $10,000 to buy two downtown billboards urging coach John Fox to bench Kyle Orton in favor of their guy. On Thursday, Tebow said thanks very much, but he would just as soon wait his turn. I wonder if his hesitation to take the field has anything to do with the fact that the Broncos already seem to have lost more key players to injury than any other team.
Well, he did say a nice thing. He said, don't buy the billboards, send the money to my charity, which is a good thing for Tim Tebow to say. Yeah, the Broncos are very much injured, especially on defense. Champ Bailey is in trouble. You got Elvis Dumervil, couldn't play at all last year because he had torn a muscle in his chest, has now got some sort of shoulder thing going on. So, yeah, they're in trouble, and I think their troubles go way beyond Kyle Orton or Tim Tebow.
University of Oklahoma Regents will meet to discuss that team's possible departure from the Big 12 on Monday. So do we expect the conference to implode by, say, Tuesday?
They're gone. I don't know what they're getting together unless it's to coordinate airplane tickets and schedules and help everybody pack, help everyone pack to their eventual move to the Pac 308 or whatever it's going to become.
Boise State has been served with a 3-year probation by the NCAA. University President Bob Custras says the program's rapid growth from Division II to a top 25 team was responsible for the violations.
Wait a minute.
I don't mean to laugh. I suppose recruiting restrictions, scholarship reductions, and limitations on practices during spring training will certainly solve that problem, right?
First of all, don't go on probation for tennis, okay? That's just silly. All right, unless you're a college in Australia, don't go on probation for tennis.
Mm-hmm.
But President Kustra, that's an interesting argument he's making. He's saying their cheating was so successful,
mm-hmm.
it hampered his ability to
find and
obey the rules.
Right.
We cheated so well that I was so busy cheating I couldn't pay attention to the rules. This makes perfectly logical sense to me. Anything in college sports makes sense. That makes sense to me. You can be too busy to cheat to pay attention to the rules. I have no doubt about that.
South Carolina head coach Steve Spurrier said last spring that he would pay his football players $300 apiece out of his own pocket if the NCAA would allow him to do that. This week, he agreed with a group that maintained that those players are actually worth something in excess of $120,000. Would Coach Spurrier's salary cover that?
Oh, I don't think there's any question it would. I think that's boutonniere money for Coach Spurrier.
I'm sure.
But
you're
think
right.
The largest story, of course, is that things are coming to a critical mass in big time college sports. You had Taylor Branch on earlier. The Atlantic gets read by people like college presidents who might not otherwise see a story like that. The system is going to crash and something's going to take its place. And if people running college sports are smart, they'll do what they can to control the crash and arrange the aftermath. If not, it's going to come down around their ears.
On Thursday, the Detroit Tigers' winning streak ended at 12 when they lost to the Oakland Athletics. I don't usually root against winning streaks, but this loss seems to me a good thing personal hygiene-wise, don't you think?
Yeah, Jim Leyland changed his underwear finally. He's wearing the same underwear for the winning streak. I'm very happy that the Tigers are doing well and even more happy for Mrs. Leyland, who can now live in the same time zone as her husband.
And also for all the reporters, beat reporters, who have to interview the manager after the game.
In his underwear.
When he's always in his underwear, no matter who he is or what team he's managing. On Tuesday, Red Sox knuckleballer Tim Wakefield, the oldest major leaguer, won his 200th game, and so he's already looking forward to 300, right?
He needed 18 runs to do it. It had been a long slog for Tim. He had his bullpen give him up a couple times when he was doing it. I suspect, although I wouldn't bet on it, that he won't be around for 300.
To be fair, he didn't need all 18 of those runs.
No, he needed seven of them.
For the 19th consecutive season, the Pittsburgh Pirates will end the season below .500. But don't worry. Things are looking up in Pittsburgh. Wait, have I got that right?
Yeah, they started fast, and they absolutely fell into the abyss after the All-Star break. But they have young players. They finally have an ownership that seems committed to winning baseball and not just putting revenue-sharing money in their pockets. So, yeah, and they do have, by the way, in case anyone asks, the nicest of the new ballparks. And, of course, a fan base that's one of the best in Major League Baseball. So, yeah, I think there's a little bit of cause for optimism in Pittsburgh.
On Monday night, Novak Djokovic concluded a tennis season during which he won 64 matches and lost only two by winning his third major of the year. That was the U.S. Open. Maureen Connolly, Don Budge, Rod Laver, Margaret Court, and Steffi Graf have each won all four major tournaments in the same year. So maybe they had better years than Mr. Djokovic, but maybe not. What do you say?
Well, it's being argued that it's the greatest tennis season ever. It may well be the greatest tennis season that a male player has ever had. But when you consider that Steffi Graf was ranked number one for almost four consecutive years, I think Novak's still got a ways to go.
Champions League soccer is underway, and this week when Real Madrid played a game in Zagreb, Cristiano Ronaldo was greeted with boos and derisive whistles. How do you like Ronaldo's explanation for the reception he got?
He's too rich and he's too good-looking, mm-hmm. and people hate him. Don't hate him because he's rich and good-looking. Hate him because he's a jackass.
Charlie, the never-ending search for great headlines, conducted by Only a Game producer Karen Given, has finally borne fruit. An international collection of acrobatic athletes gathered in Seoul, engaged in a competition involving a tightrope stretched across a river, and so, according to the Washington Post,
Skywalkers in Korea cross Han Solo. And do you know what kept them going? Hope Solo.
Oh, absolutely.
And can I just say that my ancestral home, Kerry, will be playing Dublin for the All-Ireland Football Championship on Sunday at Croke Park. Up the kingdom, my friends. The cup is coming home to where it belongs.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America, among other books. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Use the force, Bill.
In Boston, there is trembling, and it's safe to say there's fear. The Red Sox, once October-bound, seem poised to disappear. But those who find this hideous have failed to understand our teams can flat amaze us in two ways, and ain't it grand? Oh, they can hit the long home run that wins the crucial game, or sink the buzzer-beating shot that brings about the same result, or they can benefit from some official's call. My point, by these exciting plays or lucky breaks, we're all afforded such excitement that we realize anew why all these games engage us, as these games so often do. But hey, the point is entertainment. What the games provide is colorful diversion on the quiet, desperate ride through daily irritations, bills, commuting, broken stuff, the droning politicians who can make us cry, "Enough!" And who'd deny that failure can be entertaining, too? The shot that hits the post, perhaps. It's sad, but also true, that we will talk of almost this and what if that as well. These sagas built on failure, rich as any we can tell. So see the possibilities in each potential crash. The stories in the falling off, more likely gold than trash. For you're not thinking leaking roof or tires that are shot. If you are sinking with a team, that's all the grief you've got. Quiz time. Name the test of skill and strength, which involves pioneer men, women, and children, and takes place twice a year in a tiny Indiana town. If you guessed the Indy 500, well, you're just wrong. Stumped? I'm talking, of course, about the National Muzzle-Loading Rifle Association's Tomahawk Throwing Competition. The most recent contest began last week. Gabe Bullard of WFPL in Louisville was there and has this story of flying steel.
Twice a year, the National Muzzle-Loading Rifle Association holds national meetings in the town of Friendship, Indiana, population 49. Depending on turnout, the events could increase the population 20 times, and they definitely increase the volume. The sound of black powder flintlock rifles is constant around the rendezvous, as members practice for or compete in any of the several dozen shooting competitions. But on a hillside away from the shooting, there's a different sound.
This, I think, is my wife's tomahawk.
Eric Bai edits Muzzle Blasts, the NMLRA's magazine. Like most of the people in this part of the meeting site, he's dressed in pioneer garb, and he's demonstrating the proper tomahawk throw.
It's just like throwing a baseball. You don't put any English on it, nothing. No sidearm, just bring it back and let go at the right moment, and then you'll hit the target.
A well-thrown tomahawk turns once in the air and is tossed from about 6 or 7 paces from the target. The target is a card with 3 dots on it, stapled to a disc of a tree trunk standing on a tripod. There are 5 targets in the range.
If I hit the card in such a way that I cut one edge, then I usually get 2 points. If I really bisect that card and cut 2 edges, then it's a 3-point hit.
The tomahawk and knife throwing competitions last for a week. Attendees can enter as many times as they want for $1.25 a try. The highest score wins. There's a more serious aggregate score competition, though. That involves 10 throws and no second tries. And throwers have to be in period costume for that one. The tomahawk throwing is in what's called the primitive camp, where attendees use authentic 18th century equipment to spend the week sleeping and shooting outdoors. And they've been doing it since the 30s. Pretty much just like this.
Yeah, we're just trying to make it fairly easy to compete so that they can come up and do it often and have plenty of fun.
Melissa Backscheider is the range officer. She says the low cost of entry is part of the appeal of the competition. It's easy to get started throwing tomahawks, and it'll set you back $30 to $100 for your own hawk, whereas a gun and the requisite gear can cost thousands. That could be one reason why there's a tough competition in the women's category.
We are competing against other moms that are also trying to drive kids everywhere and have not a whole lot of practice time. So, yeah, the guys can get perfect 25s, but if we have, like, anywhere from, say, 15 to 18, we could win still at our thing. And we get medals. So being able to go back to the PTA and show your medal for taking first place in a tomahawk event, it definitely increases self-esteem and it gives the mom something to do and not just ride herd on the kids.
Not many people enter the competition on the first day. They usually wait until they're warmed up at the end of the week. But of the 2 who entered on opening day, half were women. Nicole Diemer drove in from Ohio. She threw several rounds, and her top score was a respectable 10.
Sometimes men don't want women shooting or throwing tomahawk. It's just different, you know, to get women out doing things that, you know, no, we can do it too. So it's fun. It's fun. They should come out and just do what men do too.
Diemer's presence on the range isn't unusual to anyone here, but back in civilization, she says things are a little different.
It's odd. It is odd because I remember back at work we had to do some kind of program where you had to show your life story or whatever. And last year I did a picture of the tomahawk and a picture of shooting, and they were like, wow, you do that. It's just something different.
With the exception of the crafters or employees, the people at the rendezvous don't make a living at this. They'll leave and go on to do something completely different. But everyone here, man or woman, says it's relaxing to go to Friendship, even if they don't throw tomahawks. For some people, like Dennis Straits, spending a weekend in buckskin pants isn't just relaxing, it's better than real life.
If I walk down the street in my rendezvous clothes, why, people think I was weird. And, but when you come here, everybody looks alike, and so everybody accepts what you look like and what you are and what you like to do.
Straits has been interested in the pioneer lifestyle for decades, and many of the others here started young as well. Melissa Backscheider's sons and daughters throw tomahawks. She says kids get an instant confidence boost when they hit the target.
We had one kid that wasn't doing so hot everywhere else, but once he stuck the tomahawk, his eyes lit up, his face lit up, and after we were closed for the day, he came back and threw some more because he actually achieved something.
As we're talking, Steve Haley approached to collect a medal from the June competition for his son, who just turned 9.
Well, let's say I just hope he throws it only at chunks of wood.
Haley's son has placed in 2 competitions, and he hopes to compete in more next year.
I think he gains respect, but he also takes a lot of pride in the fact that he actually placed first.
To be clear, plenty of men, burly, strong, mountain men surely, enter the competition too. But it's going to take kids to make the tomahawk throwing and the rendezvous last. Again, the NMLRA's Eric Bai.
Yeah, I think that we were bigger some years ago, maybe 10 or a dozen years ago we were bigger. Unfortunately, we're an older group, and sadly, many of our members die in the course of a year, and it's a little difficult to replace them as fast as they die.
The organization is planning more youth outreach, but they may not have to look beyond the tomahawk range.
That was close. Yeah, he loves the outdoors.
Throughout the day, parents like Adam Christie brought their sons and daughters out to throw tomahawks.
Ooh, that was close. Good job.
For Only a Game, I'm Gabe Bullard.
Barely.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Jillian Guybe, and we had help this week from Hillary Barngrove McQuilkin. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Gabe Bullard's Tomahawk Photo Gallery or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Fantasy League analyst A.J. Mass, who channels one of his ESPN colleagues.
Yeah, well, Timmy's a good guy. He's fun to meet from time to time there. Okay, guys, see ya.
I only know that's not Tim Kirchin because he didn't say the Yankees are still the Yankees. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.